God, y'all got a craft. Thank you, Suzanne. I am Dot M from Statesboro, Georgia, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. When they were reading the portion of chapter 5, where it says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length of it to get it, I remembered one night in Statesboro, we were having a meeting, and we had Raymond D., who was on a cane, could barely move, and Johnny T., that was on a cane and could barely breathe, and Dr. John was there on oxygen. And they're up on the stage, and I get up to read that portion of chapter 5 where it says, if you want what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, I couldn't help but stop and say, who in the hell wants what we got? Oh, and I couldn't help but think about that with all of us having to be helped, you know, and all that. There was a day we didn't have to be helped too much, physically anyway. But I'm glad I'm here to be helped. I'm supposed to tell you what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I'm like now. And I was fortunate enough one time to have the opportunity to be invited to Bill Wilson's house at Stepping Stones to spend some Sunday afternoon with he and Lois. And I was too new, really. I'd been sober just a few years, but that ain't near long enough to have good sense. And I was so sick, I didn't realize just what an opportunity it was until way later. And we were wanting some quick answers, as somebody mentioned last night. We wanted to ask Bill and have him tell us directly the answers to these things. You know, it's hard to read that big book when you're fresh, sober, and understand it and get anything out of it. And so I really looked forward to that, because what I wanted was some quick answers. I wanted him to tell me exactly what you could do and couldn't do, and he just didn't do that. We had a lot of things that in our minds we really didn't take a piece of paper with them listed. I was embarrassed to do that. I would have if I hadn't been still so embarrassed about things. And but he did not give us any quick answers. Mostly what he said was, try it. If it works, you'll know it worked. If it doesn't work, you'll know it didn't work. And he did not ever answer directly a question that we asked him. And I know now that he knew the answers are in the big book. And but I wasn't well enough to understand that big book. You know, AA is a program of attraction. And I was attracted to the people. I was not attracted to a program. I didn't understand it. And I didn't, I was too sick for a program, but I wasn't too sick to be attracted to the people I wanted what they had. And I hope we can all remember that. I've tried to remember that, is that if people aren't interested in the program, if they're interested in the people and what's there enough to keep going back, that's okay with me. Because if they hang around enough and we can share with them, maybe they'll get sober, because I feel that way about it, because that's what I did. I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous by the grace of God. And I'm so grateful to be, you know, I used to think about it, I didn't ever want to get old, but I'm grateful I've been around long enough to get old, you know. And to be an old-timer is still strange to me, because, you know, old-timers say a lot of strange things. And I thought, God, I wish they'd shut up. And I was thinking this morning, too, with all these old-timers in here and these people with all this sobriety, wouldn't it be boring if we didn't have these young people? I just think, you know, I get hungry for some other people with some time, but if it wasn't for the young people coming in this program, it would be dull, y'all. So thank you, God, for the young people. I hope you keep coming and be here to help us, because I've seen some of us get pretty crazy in our old days. And so I'm glad I've hung around long enough to become an old-timer. I'm going to try to keep my... I want to share with you, most of you all are familiar with drinking. I want to qualify. I want to say enough that you'll know I'm in the right place, because I wasn't sure for a good while. I knew my husband needed to get sober. Now, before I start, my husband died in 1983. And I've managed through this program and the people in it and the grace of God to go on with my life. And I got that from Alcoholics Anonymous. If it hadn't been for that, I wouldn't have been able to do it. It was hard, but I've been able to do it. Anything I've had to do, I've been able to do it through this program and the grace of God. I'm just going to tell you, I came from a home that I grew up in the country. And my daddy was a farmer, among some other things, like cotton gin and mail carrier, and ran a store and all that. I grew up in a good home. Now, I wouldn't have told you that when I first came in, that's not unusual. But I had one thing I want you all to know before I get any further. I grew up in the Baptist church. What they call the Old Line Primitive Baptist Church. That means that now the Old Line don't have music. Now the Progressive that my mother was a member of had a piano, so that was the Progressive. And I grew up in a home, and I want you to know that I do have moral principles. Don't tell me an alcoholic don't have good moral principles just because they go out and do all this mess. Don't mean they don't have principles, but by God, I got them. I still got them. And it was not my principles that was the problem. It was the alcohol that I was drinking that kept me doing things that I didn't need to do. But I didn't know that. I had a good time drinking for a long time. And I hadn't thought about it. When I started taking the inventory, I knew I had passed out, but I thought everybody did that drank. I didn't think that was unusual. And then I'm sure now I was alcoholic when I married. And soon after I got married, I knew my husband was an alcoholic, or he was a drunk or whatever. Back then, you didn't hear much about alcoholism. And I knew he needed to get himself straightened out. And I felt before we got married that all he needed was a good woman. And I knew his first wife, so I knew she was a good woman, you know. But you got to know how to handle a man. So I got married, I had a problem, all right, but it was him. We'd been married, I guess, a year when he went on his first drunk. And, of course, I'm just as drunk. I want to tell y'all, I was just as drunk through all this as he was, but I never one time looked at me. I was always so busy watching him, I did not have time to see what I was doing. I didn't want to see it either. But I'm sure now we were both alcoholics when we got married, because he later, when he, in his inventory, admitted that he had been off places in DTs before I ever met him. But they don't tell you things like that before you marry them. They just don't do it. But anyway, I knew he needed right away. We had everything in the world to be happy, but we were having a lot of problems. He had been married 10 years and had not had any children. We were not sure we could have children, and we were married 1 year when our first child was born, and we just were the happiest. That's all I'd ever wanted out of life anyway, was to get married and have a family and be happy ever after. And that's not asking so much, and I thought that was all there was to it. And it's just not it. But it's good we don't know all this before we get married. I am thankful. I am so thankful I didn't know all this. But right away, after the baby, when the baby was 5 months old, was when we went on our first cure trip for him. We went down to Florida, and he attempted suicide. He was going to drown himself, and That would have been a pretty good deal, I guess, but it didn't work. Anyway, I survived that, and we went on through life. We had three children, three boys, in the first 5 years of our marriage, about that. And all this trouble going on, and I got pretty sad. And all this time I'm drinking. And somewhere in there, I began in having these children and having to keep up with them. I began to take some medications. I had access to them. He was a physician, and that back then they sent the samples in the offices, and everybody had a medicine cabinet just full of samples, and all you have to do is go in there and just pick what you want. And I did that. They had some pretty good stuff out back then that you could take like that. And, of course, it wasn't enough for us. We ordered narcotics wholesale eventually. When you're an alcoholic and you're trying to quit drinking, it's mighty easy. And I share this because this is my experience. It's mighty easy to reach for the next thing that's there that's going to change the way we feel, especially if you don't want any alcohol to smell, if you've got to go to work and stuff like that. So that's what we got into. And eventually, through this, I became so depressed. And I want you all to know that I would not have... I grew up in a good, stable home, I think it was, with all the good principles, but I had a lot of sick behavior that went on, and things that I didn't even recognize. I was so insecure, and have been. When I would drink, I didn't feel that insecure. I could go and be sociable and be with other people. And through those years, we were married 12 years when we got sober. But through those years, I became so depressed with three children and knowing my husband's going to die, and I know I can't live without him. Now, that calls for depression, because there's no way out of a situation like that. I'm totally dependent on him for my every need, and I didn't realize that until after I came to AA, and some old-timer got up, and I was new, but I wanted what those people had. I liked those people. They told jokes. We had fun. They were not boring. But that old-timer got up and said, if you're dependent on another human being for your happiness, you are going to be sadly disappointed. And that hit me. I was sitting right there on the front row. It hit me right between the eyes. That's the first time I'd realized I'm totally dependent on my husband for my every need. He's my security. And, you know, a drunk, that's not much security. He's my security. I'm dependent on him, emotionally security, financial security, and that was bad, something to be dependent on for me, financial, because it was real short. And my happiness, everything depended on him. But when I heard what that man said, I was new in AA, and I really grabbed onto that. And the first thing I started working on, besides not drinking at that time, was trying to find some security for myself. And I've discovered in this program that my security depends on God and my relationship with God, and how much faith I have in God. And that is my only real security. And I am so thankful that I was able to find it. It took me a long time. Sometimes I hate to tell people how long it took me, but I do want to tell you a little bit about what I went through in the early stages, just in case somebody in here is in the early stage and might need to hear it. I tell my pigeons, I call them pigeons. there's a story behind that, but I'm not going to tell it. Let me tell you this. During my alcoholism and those years, I became so depressed that I started going to the psychiatrist. And the reason I went to the psychiatrist, my husband would go to sleep and burn the rug. And I was scared he was going to burn us up, so I had to stay awake to watch him so we wouldn't burn up. And one day during that time, he got a rug and brought it home and put it under his bed where his hand would fall and he'd drop the cigarette. And I said, well, don't you know the other carpet will burn, but this one will burn too. It's not going to keep you from setting the house on fire. He said, that's my rug. I bought it with my money, and I bought it to burn. And he was a good teacher, and he could explain things so well, but I couldn't understand that. So I decided I'm the one that needs to go to the psychiatrist. I'd been going with him and telling him all I knew about him, and by that time I had so many resentments, I was making up a lot to tell him about him. But I had never told him anything about myself. So I decided if I can't understand that as plain as he's making it to me, I must be crazy. So I started going to the psychiatrist for me. I still didn't tell him anything. I'm sure he asked me if I drank. I don't know whether he did or not. But I'm sure if he did, I just told him I might take a drink occasionally with my husband. So I went to him. I mean, I knew something was wrong with me, but I thought he had driven me crazy. And I still think any woman alcoholic, and man too, it's not just for women, ought to have a spouse to blame it on. It sure does make it easier for you to drink. And so I started going to the psychiatrist, and of course I had all the pills he could give me, but he gave me more. Every time I'd go and tell him I'm worse than I was, he'd give me some more. I took what I had at home, I took what he gave me, and kept what he'd already given me. And I got into some pretty bad trouble with my depression. Anybody that drinks like I was drinking and take pills like I was taking was going to have trouble and go crazy. So I walked in one day, the depression. I think that's had a lot to do with me not going back to drinking because of that depression. I don't believe I could get through it again. I really don't believe I could go through with that like that again. And I went in one day, it got so bad. I went in one day and told the doctor. Now, here I am threatening the psychiatrist. I told him if he didn't help me and do something for me, I was going to commit suicide. I thought about it all the time, but I never did verbalize it. Have you ever been where you could see your own funeral going on? And how everybody was so sorry they treated you like they did and thoroughly enjoyed it. These things were the only pleasure I was having at this time. And I had a lot of fun with that. I mean, you try it sometimes. It's really, really fun because they're real sorry. And I could see all that plain as day. But anyway, that day he put me in the hospital and began to give me electric shock treatments. Now, so far as I know, I'm still drinking. I'm still taking what he gave me to take. And the doctor prescribed electric shock treatments. So I know something about learning to live better electrically, as somebody said. And it was, I didn't talk about that for a long time because I didn't want to say that until I heard another woman one time say that she had electric shock treatments, but that she was in a state hospital and they didn't give her anything. They just hooked those wires up and turned the juice on and that was it. And she didn't like them. She said she hated them. But I liked them and I didn't tell her. I didn't tell her I liked them. Now this is, I don't know what he was treating. My depression is what he was treating. And back then there wasn't a lot of treatment for alcoholism. And he was treating the depression. And I did not know until I got in AA and started thinking about this thing and looking at it that I realized it was not the shock treatments that I got addicted to. It was the sodium pentothal that they gave me before the shock treatments. It's legal. I didn't have to steal it. doctors gave it to me, and they gave it to me for a reason. It was treating my depression, and there was nothing wrong with it. And every time I felt a nervous coming on or a breakdown, see, you call them nervous breakdowns were the end thing back then. I mean, we all, women at parties, you really talk about your nervous breakdowns. And so that's what happened, and I really realized that after I'd been in AA a long time, that I had become addicted to that sodium pentothal that they gave me in my vein. It was the only relief that I got at that time. I was not getting relief from the drinking. I was not getting any relief from the drugs. Everything had turned against me. And that's when my husband got desperate enough. Well, he got desperate enough after he was sentenced somewhere for a while, and he had left this, he went to Lexington, Kentucky, and he had left that place a few weeks before against medical advice, and they told him if he didn't stay, he would probably be back in a couple of weeks, and he was, and he didn't go in his little Thunderbird. He went on the airplane with the deputy sheriff, and if he left there, he'd have had to go on to Reidsville. And we thought it was the end of the world. I did, because I'm dependent on him, and I'm sick, and I needed him. It's the best thing that ever happened. He stayed there 4.5 months, and in there is where they gave him an AA sponsor from the outside that they let him come in and sponsor him while he was in that hospital facility, a prison, whatever it was. And that man helped him to see that he had had an alcohol problem all along. He was so grateful for that man, because he was a man that was retired and had nothing to do but do that. And he just that's where he found out about AA program and what it could do, and had a lot of respect for that program. They even let him go on the outside to an AA meeting before he came home. And when he came home is when I started going to AA. I had no desire to be sober. I didn't know I needed to be sober. I didn't know I had a drinking problem. And I didn't know I had a problem with these things. And that shows we can die with this illness and never know what's wrong. That's one of the cunning, baffling, powerful things about it. And it's really a rough thing to see. We started going to AA everywhere when he came back, but this is where, now a lot of people say, I went to AA and everything's been beautiful ever since. And I want y'all to know it was not that way with me. When I got sober, I tell you the truth, I had played hell. I wouldn't drink, and I wouldn't take drugs, I wouldn't take anything to make me feel better. After I got sober. But now there in the beginning, this is where the old timers come in again. I went to a Sunday afternoon meeting. It was I guess it was district by that time. It used to be something else. But anyway, there was an old timer there, and you didn't hear much like that at that time. But he said, if you're sitting out there on mood-changing drugs, you'd be better to go back to your alcohol. I was not drinking because I didn't want my husband to drink. But I still was taking the drugs the doctor gave me, and some he didn't give me. But I couldn't have gone to the meeting if I hadn't taken them, I don't think. I was too sick. I had diarrhea because I wasn't drinking, and I was, you know, trying to go watch him good. And he got up there and said, if you're sitting out there taking mood-changing drugs, you'd be better off to go back to your liquor. And I heard what that man said. And I'd just been going to AA a short time when I went home and threw all those things away. And you know why I did it? Because I liked what you all had. I wanted what you all had. And I meant to get it. And I was more focused on that than anything else. But my resentment, y'all, was terrible. See, I wasn't drinking and taking any drugs to kill all that stuff in there and to quieten it down. And I had the impact of all these resentments that I had built up over the years. And they really came out. And just to give you an example of what it was like, I took a lot out on my children. I took a lot out on my husband. I blamed him for everything. And the saddest thing about it, I told him he was responsible for all my problems because I was all right until I met him. And I believe that. You know, alcoholism can be kind of like a pregnancy. It's not. Sometimes it doesn't show in the beginning. But sooner or later, if you got it, it's going to show. And that's kind of the way I've looked at this illness, you know. And so I had resented him for everything. By now, I knew he'd been alcoholic long before I met him, and he didn't tell me. And he'd been dishonest about a lot of things, and I just called him sorry as hell. I don't know, C.D. talks about that, being sorry as hell, and I could call him anything in the world, but don't call me sorry. But I figured that was a pretty good name for it. That's what I heard at home. And I just told him he didn't care. He didn't have any principles and all that, see. And this is after I'm sober. All these resentments came out full force. And to show you how bad they were, I had told him during his drinking years that if he would lie down and go to bed and go to sleep at night like a man ought to, he'd be all right. That I'd be all right. And now he's been off, he's back, he's going to AA, he's sober, he's lying down at night, going to sleep like a man ought to, and I am madder than hell. Now, I know I'm not the only person in this world that does that, but now he's the one that caused all the trouble. And now he's lying there sound asleep, snoring, and I can't sleep. And my resentment's just coming, coming, coming. You know, you can do that just so long. And it's kind of like a pressure cooker. If you put it on the stove and you turn the heat on and you don't let some steam off, something's going to happen to it. It's going to blow up. Well, that happened to me one night. He was sleeping so peacefully, and I could not tolerate it. And I could not. And I just reached over and knocked the hell out of him. I will never forget, he looked like he'd been shot. He sat straight up in the bed and said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I want a divorce." Now, I had never asked him for a divorce. I was so scared he was going to leave me. And he said, "For what?" And I couldn't say for sleeping, because I'd been telling him all the time, you know, if he'd sleep, everything would be all right. And all I could think of is my poor little old self, pity me. I said, "Because you don't love me and you don't love these children. And besides, you never have loved them. And besides, you always got to add whipped cream on the top." And I said, "And besides, I have never loved you." That's what you had. I had to go to that length. And I'm not the only person that does that either. Al-Anons have been good at some of that too. It didn't work. I was going to join Al-Anon until I hung around long, and they didn't have a group, so I hung around long enough to diagnose my own case. But I won't ever forget, you know, he was a smart man. He was a good man too. And he said, when I told him he didn't love me and he didn't love the children, here he is sober, working his program, living with a mad woman. And he said, "Honey, I can't stop you. If a divorce is what you want, I'm not going to stop you, but I'll have no part of it. I want you to know I'm not going to be a part of it." And he said, "I'm happier than I've ever been in my life, and I have no intention of having anything to do with a divorce." Well, do you know what he did? He lay back down, turned over, and went to sleep. And I learned something. Now, I didn't learn it that night. But right after that, I learned about my insecurity more. Because after he said that, and I didn't fear him leaving me, because I had asked him, I didn't mean to ask him for a divorce, but when you get mad, you're liable to ask for anything. And I realized that I had asked him for a divorce and he didn't accept it. So I felt more secure that he loved me. And I turned over and went to sleep too. that really was the perfect thing. I'm just telling you now, if y'all need that, that's a good thing to say. Because I turned over and went to sleep. Because I didn't fear that he was going to divorce me. I thought he was going to leave me just as soon as I got well enough. That he was too much of a gentleman to leave me as sick as I was. And that he would leave me as soon as he could. And he did not accept that divorce deal. And from then on is when I really began to grow and get better. And work on my resentments toward him. And that was not... I talked one night and said it took me 10 years, and I'm going to say that. But one girl cried. She said, I don't like to hear you talk. You depressed me. And 10 years before I got desperate enough, I was hanging on by the skin of my teeth. I was doing the best I could, I believe. And I reached a point of desperation because I hadn't been good at taking my own inventory. I had all those resentments. And one night, in the middle of the night, I got so miserable, I realized that if I didn't change, I was going to have to take something or drink something. And I didn't want that. I had hung around here long enough. I loved people. I always have. I love alcoholics. I love them even drunk. You know, I wouldn't want to live with them. But, I continued to work on that. But that night, I became willing. And it says in the steps, we became entirely ready. We have to be willing. Well, that night, I was willing to change. And I'm going to tell you this because I think it's real important. I became willing to tell my husband some things I had never been willing to tell him because of my fear of rejection or losing him or something. But I told him for the first time just how much I needed him and loved him. I grew up in a home where we didn't talk about, we didn't say I love you outwardly. We knew it. I knew I was loved, but we didn't use the words. I had poor communication in a lot of areas, and I was able that night to go in crying like a baby and tell him how much I loved him and how much I needed him. And he was as happy as he could be because I'd never told him that. I was afraid to let him know how much I loved him because I was afraid it'd be used against me, and I was taught that. You know, we are taught a lot of things. The big book says we got to be willing to let go of old ideas. Do you know what your old ideas are? I had to sort out which were the old ideas and which were the principles. And it's hard to do. I heard Tom Lovern talk one time, and he said somebody told him when he came in, hey, take what you want and throw the rest out the window. And he said he got drunk, spent 4 years crawling around out that window looking for what he threw out. And you have to be real careful. Because a lot of these things that I really thought were principles, they were old ideas that I'd been a lot better off without. But I had an old idea, one of the biggest ones that I had two. One was about sex. We didn't have any sex education back then. We didn't have TVs you could look at and find out anything about it either. You just went to somebody more ignorant than you were, and they told you what they had heard. And your mamas and daddies didn't tell you anything. So I had a hang up about sex. I had to get over that, which I was able to do after I got sober. I'm married with 3 children, but that don't mean you don't have a lot of hang ups about sex. You can get it all straightened out, it sure makes it worthwhile, too. You know. And it's a big help. And another old idea I want to tell you about is my old idea about God. I had grown up, and I'm sure it wasn't all me, but I grew up believing, I knew the fear of God. My mother, if she was introduced, as a God-fearing woman. I don't want to go to church and try to love God because I'm scared to death of him. And in AA, they had a God that they called a loving God. a caring God, a protective God. And they gave God credit for the good things that happened in their life, and they didn't blame God for the bad things that happened in their life. Now that was AA people, and I loved it. I wanted whatever it was they had, and I meant to get it. Because I knew I couldn't go back where I came from, no matter how sick I got. And I worked on that, and they'd tell me what to do. They'd tell me to pray, and I was ashamed of prayer. I'd never prayed outwardly in my life to anybody, and very little except what was selfish. And they would tell me how to do that and how to start, and I did that. And I began to have what I didn't recognize at the time as little spiritual experiences. And that continued to grow. And those old ideas out of the way, I was able to make some progress. And my husband was happy when I told him how much I loved him. He was not going to use it against me like I had really been taught. So you see, I'm learning more and more about the program. I stay in a lot of study groups, big book and step groups. I like that. I never cease to be amazed at what's in that big book and in those steps for us to constantly grow. It different each time I hear it. After I got sober, one of the first things through all that resentment and everything, I got pregnant. And I hadn't planned that because I couldn't take care of what I had. I had those three. The oldest one was 11 when we got sober. And the first year I was sober, I got, I had a daughter, my first daughter. I had three boys. I had a baby girl. And I didn't plan that, but it was, God knew what I needed. And that's what's so good about this thing. God knows what we need when we don't know. And God gives us what we need when he knows we're ready for it. And he knew I was ready for that child. I didn't. But that did something for me and took my mind off of myself some. And I began to get a lot better there with that. And one thing we started doing early in our sobriety was 12-step work because there were no treatment places anywhere. They had one place in Atlanta. And I think it was the, so far as I know, where the treatment program was, the Atlanta, what was it, Joe, the clinic in Atlanta. Yeah, and Georgian Clinic is what it was called at that time. And everybody around us that got drunk and went crazy, they put them in Milledgeville. That's the insane asylum. That had something to do with me staying sober, too. And because some of those people never got out till they turned them all out. And I didn't want that. And we started just doing 12-step work and ended up with a house full of people. And somebody suggested we needed a hospital. We finally built one. And my children now, out of my four children, three of them are alcoholics. And three of them, I used to say, were married to alcoholics. One of them's been married to alcoholics two times. He's not married right now. But he's sober and been sober and is doing about like I did, growing in this program. My youngest son, I think he's got about 20 years now, and went to medical school after he had been sober a long time. Thank God he waited till he'd been sober a while. And and my daughter that had the one that was born after we were sober, she'd never known anything about drinking except being around the people we brought in the house. And we ended up with 20 people in our house one time with all those children, and we didn't have a place to sleep. Children had to move out in the backyard. And so we did build a hospital. And now those children are running that hospital. I'm over there not all the time anymore. And that daughter that had such a hard time getting sober went to law school and graduated and came back, and she's working for us. They love it. They've always loved the alcoholics. And I'm grateful for that. I can't think, I want to say this, I cannot think of a better way for our family to have ended up than like we are. We are an AA family. My oldest son, the only one that's not alcoholic, didn't drink. He knew better. With what he came from, he knew better. But he loves alcoholics as much as anybody I've ever seen. And he was with us during the time his daddy died. He was our medical director, and he's off in Cary, North Carolina now, doing in a private practice there, family medicine. And he went into family medicine so he would be thrown with alcoholics to work with, because we believe, and he believes, it's a family illness. And so he's got him a lot of alcoholics on the side. He just loves alcoholics. And I don't know why he loves them so good when he's not one. And but our family, we've learned to communicate. We've learned to say what we need to say. And most of the time we can say it appropriately, but sometimes we don't, and we understand that. And I am so happy. I wouldn't change places with anybody I know. And I give credit to a loving God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of loving people. And I want to tell you one, somebody asked me to tell this. I don't tell it usually, but it shows you a little bit about how I grew up. And out in the country with entertainment, we didn't have a lot of entertainment like you city people. And I was 6 miles out from Statesboro, and we had a picture show, but couldn't go to that very often. I think it just opened at 9 or something. And we didn't get to go to a lot of that, but we had good recreation out in the country. It was good fun, too. And my daddy grew a lot of watermelons. And you just grow a whole field full of watermelons and haul them off or turn the hogs in or something. That you couldn't sell them, couldn't do anything with it. So we were creative. And what we learned to do was have watermelon roast. And I don't know whether any of you know about watermelon roast or not, but you missed a lot if you don't. We would take all those watermelons and put them, it's kind of like a barbecue grill. And you put your watermelons on there, and everybody gathers just about dark. And then those watermelons, they keep turning and turning and turning and turning, and after a while, it's dark, not much moon, and those watermelons explode. And everybody runs out in the woods and gets a little peace. Thank you, and God bless you.